The Spectator magazine is the greatest magazine in the English language. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online to see for yourselves. Also, against my advice as editor, we're giving away a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Given that you're spending 12 quid, you can do the maths. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher. But don't hurry, because this offer probably loses us money.
Hello and welcome to the Edition podcast from The Spectator, where each week we shed a little light on the thought process behind putting the world's oldest weekly magazine to bed. I'm Laura Prendergast, The Spectator's executive editor.
And I'm Gus Carter, The Spectator's deputy features editor.
This week we'll be discussing Rishi's survival plan, we'll be charting the rise of Hillingdon Man, and asking whether Victorian parenting is the way forward. So Gus, it's Wednesday afternoon. The magazine went to press at lunchtime today and our cover line is Survival Plan, Is Rishi Ready for the Rebels? How did this one come about?
Well, this one came about because the local elections fall at a rather difficult time for us. They're taking place tomorrow and we had a chat on Monday morning about whether or not it was worth doing a Scotland cover pegged to the fact that the First Minister has just stepped down, and we decided that by Saturday, when a lot of our readers get their magazine, it'll probably be a bit late. So we came up with the idea of doing a piece on Rishi Sunak's rearguard action against a potential plot from Tory backbenchers. And Lara, you actually had the particularly good idea of of redoing a cover that we did in October 2022, Is Rishi Ready, of him walking up the number 10 stairway. And now on our cover, he's got a kind of barricade and a colander on his head and a broom, ready for the rebels to come and get him.
And to discuss further, we spoke with Katie, our political editor who wrote the piece, and Stephen Bush, associate editor of the Financial Times.
Katie, you write that this week is the week that Rishi Sunak has been preparing for since he became Prime Minister. Can you tell us why?
Yeah, I think it's because it's always inevitably been the point when Rishi Sunak would be the most exposed. You had the local elections last year. They did not go well for Rishi Sunak. Everyone said they were priced in. The time at which he had taken power meant he wouldn't have too much impact on them. You had expectation management, the then Tory party chairman saying, oh, we could lose 1,000 seats. They lost more. I think it sent almost kind of this death spiral narrative, and it really stopped any sense of a Rishi Sunak recovery. But because they were so soon after Rishi Sunak taking over, it was never really seen as the ultimate danger point. We're now at the last local elections before a general election. He has been in post for some time. The polls have not improved. If anything, they've gone backwards. And the last time a lot of these councils and these mayoralities were tested was the Boris Johnson high point of 2021, when you had that 30-foot Boris balloon in Hartlepool, the by-election at the same time. And it was almost came to signify this ultimate dominance of Boris Johnson in the Tory party while Keir Starmer was struggling. It means that the high point, it means lots of these councils and so forth were always going to be hard to hold. You add to that the current polling, you add to that the current mood, and it's going to be a really tricky few days. And I think it's why number 10 have always been trying to build up a way to kind of increase the chance of Rishi Sunak getting through it. And you've seen in recent weeks announcements which are very friendly to the Tory party, a boost to defence spending, a benefits crackdown, the Rwanda bill receiving royal assent, you know, the week before you go into these local elections. And I think it's all meant to kind of say to MPs, there's a plan, don't, you know, give in the face of bad results and go to another chapter of psychodrama. But we're not going to really know probably until early next week whether they've done enough to make that happen.
Stephen, voting's taking place right now. Can you tell us what the best plausible outcome is for the Conservative Party?
I think the best plausible outcome for the Conservative Party, now, even though I think actually the Metro Mayor, indeed one of the reasons why they're a great innovation, is as we saw in 2021 when the Labour Party in a plainly disastrous set of local elections was able to gain two of them while losing councils elsewhere. I think the best case scenario would be one in which the Conservative Party wins the new North York mayoralty, holds on to both the Tees Valley and the West Midlands, and actually, given the personalised circumstances of the the local mayoralties. It's plausible, right, then due to Birmingham's bankruptcy, Andy Street might be able to be re-elected by actually as good a margin as he did last time around, right, given the personalised nature of those contests. And then for the Labour Party to have enough bad results in areas where it competes with the Greens and Liberal Democrats due to the party's stance over the Israel-Hamas war, that the Labour Party has a kind of outbreak of, you know, what is this party for? You know, why, you know, like, why haven't we called for a cease? Why didn't we call for a ceasefire earlier, etc., etc.? All of which would give Rishi Sunak the best possible sort of spin he could put on these contests. And then I suppose also the police and crime commissioners, which are, yeah, because basically the Conservatives are the only party which genuinely competes across all of England. Basically, the Liberal Democrats are a party for the posh bits of outer London and rural areas, and the Labour Party a party for everywhere else. The Conservatives compete in all of those places, which means the shape of the PCC races does slightly advantage them. So one in which they hold off most of the challenges in the PCC races is another sort of plausible best-case scenario.
And Katie, you mentioned in the piece the Blackpool South by-election. Can you tell us what's going on there?
Yeah, so this is held during the local elections and it's going to be one of the results we get pretty early. Mm. So I think as much as people say you're not going to have a full picture of things probably till Saturday afternoon, you know, even then it won't be the end. Obviously, as journalists, you need to write copy. And as MPs, you need to panic or celebrate. It's just, if you are unlucky enough that your bad results come early, you're probably going to have the bad narrative and, you know, lots of parties trip up here. But the Blackpool by-election will come early. This is sparked by Scott Benton, the no longer Tory MP, and a lobbying row. And he had a pretty small majority. So I think it's always, you know, the thinking is Labour should win it pretty comfortably. What is more interesting is who comes second. Is it Reform or is it the Tory party? The Tories are trying to beat Reform to second place. Reform obviously want to have a good showing. It's the type of seat they should be doing quite well in. And the question is, you know, routinely we have seen Reform in intention polling doing really well. There's a YouGov poll out this week which suggests the Tories only a couple of points ahead of the Reform Party. But so far, they are yet to match an electoral test. So can they use these local election results? Well, they're not standing in many places, to be honest. But I think the Blackpool by-election will be one of those. If they do get into second place, I think that's going to freak a lot of Tories out. But also, if they don't, if we do, as is being rumoured, have Nigel Farage announce in 2 weeks' time that he's returning to lead the Reform Party, they'll still be freaked out. So, but I think, you know, in terms of immediate problems for Rishi Sunak, Reform coming in second place is a big headache.
Mm. One of the ways, Stephen, that the Conservatives are trying to secure their right is through the Rwanda scheme. Katie mentions that earlier in the week, Labour aides were briefing that the party would maintain the Rwanda scheme once it comes into government until it found an alternative. They've now scrapped that. Can you tell us what's going on?
Well, I think essentially what happened is that some people in the Labour Party were... yeah, I think there are two reasons why people brief things. One, because it's going to happen, and one, because the aides in question would like it to happen. Mm. I think it was always pretty unlikely, not least that the Shadow Home team has spent the money on the Rwanda scheme, and the Shadow Treasury team is very reluctant to let departments which have said, oh, well, we won't do Rwanda, so we will do X, go, oh, maybe we will do this additional spending commitment. But there are, of course, other forces in the, you know, at the top of the Labour Party who have a different perspective. I think basically what we saw there was some of those internal divisions splitting out into the open very briefly, which is why they had that sort of slightly confused 24 hours.
Mm. And Katie, towards the end, you quote a former cabinet member who says, I do expect someone to challenge Rishi. Can you tell us who that might be?
Yeah, I love doing predictions really soon for something happening. I mean, I still think it's in the air whether you get a challenger, but what the plotters are missing is they've, you know, got their plotting, they've got their whispers, they've got their secret groups. They have a policy blueprint now that they put out, though we can debate that another time as to how realistic it is. And what they don't have is a challenger or a leader, and they've been trying to get that for some time. I think on the top of their wish list was Kemi Badenoch. I think she's made pretty clear that she does not want to be anywhere near this. And that's partly because she has such a safe seat that she, you know, will most likely, even the horror scenario, survive a bad general election result. So why would you in that scenario think, yep, I'm going to, you know, lead the Tory party and then probably lead them to some type of defeat, and then you wouldn't stick around. Therefore, I think the ones we need to look at are those who on the current polling might not be here on the other side of the election. It means you have more of an incentive to, you know, put your head above the parapet. And I think that could be, you know, Penny Morden, I think, is one to watch, Grant Shapps. I think it is amusing, MPs, that both members of the cabinet were sent out over the weekend to give interviews where they talked about, you know, how we all have to get behind the prime minister, which I think is clearly a tactic to make it a bit more embarrassing for them if they do decide to, you know, and then say, I know I did say that, but actually I think it's now to not time to not. I think Robert Jenrick is also one to look at. He obviously quit as Home Office Minister over the Rwanda scheme. He is not someone Number 10 can send out to be helpful because he is not in the government. And he has been reaching out a lot to MPs. He's also been speaking at lots of Tory events. And then also see what someone like Suella Braverman does. But I think probably those first three are the ones that, you know, the plotters are looking more towards. Now, how would this come about? I think that you'll have probably really horrible Sunday reads on the Tory party in the papers. But of course, it's a bank holiday weekend, so MPs are not going to be back in the Commons until Tuesday. And therefore, I think you're not going to know whether Sunak is out of the woods for another week or so, really.
Mm. Katie and Stephen, thank you very much.
Gus, what did you like in this week's issue?
I enjoyed David Abulafia's review of Paul Cooper's Fall of Civilizations. I enjoyed it because I tried listening to Paul Cooper's podcast and I found it really boring. But actually, David's review of the book is quite good. And he points out that ancient kind of Sumerian texts on clay tablets were preserved because invaders set fire to the kind of Sumerian buildings and they cooked the clay, which I didn't know. I found quite interesting.
There are two things I'd like to mention. The first is Damien Thompson's Life column, in which he talks about trying to convince chemists to sell him, as he puts it, mood-elevating painkillers. It's very funny. I'd commend that piece to you. And also, Joel Golby seems to have stormed into The Spectator. Not only is his book reviewed incredibly favourably this week, and he's compared to Dorothy Parker and Hazlitt and Montaigne, but also he writes the notes on this week about the third-sized pint, the sort of diminutive size of pint, and how we should all consider drinking them. And Joel also joined us on Table Talk, which is available now if anyone would like to listen to that.
Yes, Table Talk, our food and drink podcast presented by you, Lara. There is also a section of that discussion in which you go through Joel's thoughts on the perfect pint, and I thought we could listen to that now.
You just mentioned beer, and there's also a really brilliant bit in your book where you talk about a pint and how a pint is the kind of perfect weight. If you had a beer glass filled with water, it wouldn't feel quite right. And you also talk about the different types of pints. What is your ideal place to have a pint?
Oh, wow, that's a question. That is a great question. Did that chapter make you want a pint, by the way?
Yeah. Immediately send it to Ed as well.
Yeah.
This will make you want to have a pint.
Because actually I wrote it because when I'm in intense writing periods, I stop drinking just to make sure I have as much as my brain available as possible. So I was on the end of like a 3.5 month period of sobriety. And I wrote that and I finished. It was like 3 o'clock in the afternoon, slightly sunny, but still not warm, but not cold. Clouds in the sky, it was like a Tuesday, no one was around, and I was like, wow, I can go for one of those right now. And I just did. I went, and it was glorious. The ideal place to have a pint, it really, obviously it's context dependent. I really, at the moment, I think one or two on your own in a nice pub at a nice low-level hum, you know, not clattering, not too loud, not too many people trying to talk over each other or anything like that. If you've got a book there, great, but also looking at your phone is nothing like
it's
it.
It's true.
So if you're
really down on looking at your phone, but it's great.
Yeah, no, it's great. It really is. And if you've got one very cold pint with you, I did that yesterday, actually. I was recording another podcast, sorry. And I got there early, which is very out of character for me. So I went to the pub, had one pint and a really big look at my phone, and it was gorgeous. So that's always good. But then, you know, there's so many great pints that you can have. I'm not normally an airport pint kind of person, but if it's...
So you've got your tea.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. I'm doing 2-way trips to the bathroom anyway, just pure Earl Grey coming out. But yeah, like, I think, you know, we're talking in April right now and the weather is just starting to turn to that perfect and the hours have changed. Mm. And so if someone says to you at 20 to 5 today, like, pint? And I also love that one word with the inflection, pint. I love getting that text because you can make it happen very quickly. Mm. And those impromptu ones are great. Standing outside on the pavement, you still need a coat, but like you could get a bit of sun on your face. Mm. And it's just a little bumper before you take a horrible train home. Those little stolen moments, those are great ones.
There's also a brilliant piece by William Cook on, as he puts it, Hillingdon Man. Obviously, everyone's heard of Essex Man, who helped the Tories win in 1992. But Hillingdon Man, he says, is a slightly more unhappy character. We spoke to William earlier about who Hillingdon Man is. William, in the magazine this week, you write about Hillingdon, and you're surprised to find out that it was labelled Britain's unhappiest place. You live in Hillingdon. Does the survey chime with your own experience?
Well, it didn't at all, and that's what I thought made it kind of an interesting subject to dig into a little bit. It was actually a Rightmove survey, and they asked people who lived in these places, so it wasn't people projecting onto what other places they thought might be unhappy, but how people felt living in that area. And I thought, gosh, this is rather odd. I moved here 13 years ago, and I've never been happier. And it's a fantastic place. The London borough of Hillingdon, I live specifically in Ruislip and Hillingdon, straddles Hillingdon itself and various other kind of metro land suburbs. And I've had a great time there. And then I thought, well, you know, trying to dig down into why people are unhappy. And I have a hunch that it's because of this huge elephant in the room, which I think is going to be a big factor in the general election to come, which is house prices, and that people can't afford to get on the housing ladder, they can't afford to buy a house. And for various reasons, I suspect this problem is especially acute in Hillingdon.
Why do you think it's especially acute in Hillingdon?
Well, it's partly to do with the history of the place. I mean, what's unique about this ring of outer London? It was created by the Metropolitan Railway, and a lot of our listeners will know and love the Metroland poems and subsequently the Metroland documentary of Sir John Betjeman and him talking about these places. And what makes them singular is that the Metropolitan Railway created them. Rather than them laying out lines into places that already needed a railway, they put railways out to little villages and then created this kind of new commuter class. And it was a very good strategy. They bought up the land that the lines ran through, and then they sold that land off to developers, and they built this Metroland suburbia. And the key fact, I think, the key figure about this, we're talking about the 1920s mainly, is that the average, you know, upper working class, lower middle class clerk, lowly white collar worker commuting into town on this new railway, the average wage for them was about £250 a year. And that was the cost of a new Metroland house in Ruislip. So you got your back garden, your front garden, you've got an indoor toilet, you've got a garage for your new car, you've got all these things for a year's salary. And I thought, gosh, hasn't that changed? And it's particularly changed in Hillingdon due to its proximity to London. Of course, there's hardly anyone in the country now who could buy a family home for a year's annual wage. But I think in Hillingdon that was a thing, and it's now very much no longer a thing. And house prices have gone up there enormously. And the people who've grown up in that area, in one of these places that still does feel like a village, they've been priced out.
And you talk a little bit about the current 20-something generation, so I suppose the children of that commuter class being unable to buy where their parents bought. I mean, how much of a factor do you think that is in terms of the unhappiness of the people who live in Hillingdon?
Well, I think it's very profound, because the thing that really struck me about the area when I moved in is I took my daughter along on her first day at the local CV primary school, and meeting the parents in the playground, it turned out quite a lot of them had been to that primary school. Some of the grandparents had even been to that primary school. I mean, this is a very cohesive thing to have in a place that is technically part of Greater London. And clearly that is not going to continue. You know, when a family house costs £500,000 upwards, £750,000, in some parts, then people are going to have to move out, they're going to have to move on, and you will no longer get that multi-generational community in places like Ruislip. And whether you're coming at it from the left or the right, I think this is a big, big issue and a big problem for all of us.
You say in the piece that it may have particular ramifications for the Conservative Party, and that actually your area was one of the few places in London to vote Brexit. Can you talk us through how you think that's going to affect the Conservative Party?
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is, I think what makes me different from most of the people I know in the areas, most of the people I know have got very long routes, especially for somewhere that is ostensibly part of London. But I'm not from there, and I was living previously, my wife and I, we were living in Chiswick. It's a very different area, very much kind of Remainer, Ramona, kind of metropolitan, elite almost kind of place. And we were on the lower rungs of that establishment, I suppose. And then we got priced out in Chiswick, so we moved out there. So I suspect we're part of a demographic, actually, in that we're the people who are getting priced out of central London. We're moving into these places like Ruislip, and I suppose directly or indirectly displacing some of the people who've grown up there. So I was very mindful of that. And so partly I think the demographic is going to change vis-a-vis the Tory party, partly to do with people like me moving in and sort of changing that. But also it's because the attraction for the people in that neighbourhood, I think, is that they could live the C2 dream. You know, they could live the Thatcherite. I mean, it's kind of milder version of Essex and Basildon and so on. You know, that you could, your father maybe worked in a big unionised factory, company, whatever. You decided to set up on your own. You got your own business. Your parents lived in a council house. You bought your own house. You know, you're part of that Thatcherite, C2, upper working class, aspirational generation. And when the aspirational people, when they can no longer get what they aspire to, they're going to become very disillusioned, I think.
Just to slightly play devil's advocate, William, obviously the house prices are going up in Hillingdon, so people are moving to Hillingdon and paying £500,000 for a house. Who are those people in there? Are they happy to be living in Hillingdon?
Well, I mean, I think they're kind of people like me, really. And I think we are very happy because we're getting the benefits of the wonderful culture that was created in these places, you know, with one foot in the countryside and one foot in the city, and all the advantages of rural life and all the very few of the disadvantages of urban life. I mean, it really does feel like a village or a small town, partly because of the longevity of the other people who've lived there.
So you're part of the problem then? You're a gentrifier?
Yeah, I am part of the problem. And I can see, you know, that it's like all people that discover a new place. They, in a sense, they help to destroy what they covered, don't they? It's a destructive force, I think. I mean, London's always had this churn, but I think what's interesting about Hillingdon, it's historically been one of the places that had very little churn. You know, it was more provincial, if you like, and it's now becoming sucked into the big city. And I think the people there, you know, they're not worse off than anyone else, but they've lost more. They've had more to lose.
William, thank you very much for joining.
And finally, Mary Wakefield writes in defence of Victorian parenting in this week's magazine. She says that kids these days could benefit from stiff upper lip parenting and the resilience she learnt from her time at boarding school. She also warns against encouraging children to focus on their feelings and sending them to therapy. To discuss this, we were joined by Jean Twangy, author of the Generation Tech Substack and the book Generations, The Real Difference Between Gen Z, Millennials, Gen X, Boomers and Silence, and what they mean for America's future. And we were also joined by The Spectator's literary editor, Sam Leith.
Jean, in the magazine this week, Mary Wakefield writes her column in defence of a more old-fashioned parenting style, and she argues that children's desires should come second to adults. What do you make of that? Do you think children can benefit from a bit of tough love?
Well, you know, I partially agree and partially disagree. So it is true that things tend to go better in the house when parents are not concerned with their children being happy in every moment or always putting the child's needs first. That those things tend to backfire because then the children don't learn to deal with adversity. And then when they go to school or grow up and get a job, then they're shocked when they're not treated as special and their feelings considered at every moment. So I think there is certainly something to be said for that type of parenting that is not quite as child-centered. On the other hand, we don't want to take it too far. The piece and the bad therapy book that it refers to both suggests that spanking is just fine, which we know it's not, from decades and decades of research that, first of all, it doesn't work very well as a behavior modification technique. And second, it increases the risk of the child being aggressive. I mean, spanking basically says, like for a kid who, say, is aggressive toward other children, oh, I'm going to hit you to tell you that hitting other people is wrong. Like it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense and it doesn't seem to work well. So moderation, that parenting style of being loving but firm, but not including physical spanking, better idea.
Sam, what do you make of firm parenting?
Well, you're probably hoping for a kind of fantastic ding-dong between your guests, but I'm afraid I'm slightly in Jean's corner. I am in this, as in almost all things, an absolutely irredeemable centrist dad, which is to say, I absolutely agree that children need boundaries and they need structure. And if they feel that they're in the driving seat, their deformations of character will tend to get completely out of control. And I'm also with Jean in that I think spanking, it's funny that we're still arguing about spanking. You go back to kind of early theorists of childhood like Locke and Rousseau. And, you know, Locke said, look, if you scare your child into behaving, you're getting it wrong, because they'll respond to fear and they'll do things for fear of being caught rather than because they've arrived at a rational idea modeled by example on how you ought to behave in the world and your obligations to other people. And so it's a very, very old argument. I mean, I think, you know, Mary describes her childhood as Victorian. You know, I know Mary's parents and they are of the in the old fashioned line. I had a kind of more mixed kind of childhood. I think my parents were kind of quite sort of progressive type 1970s parents. I mean, my dad was forever kind of, you know, my mother would work and my father would be at home looking after the children and making his own bread and his own pesto and growing his own weed in the allotment. And, you know, he would. And so I had very affectionate and loving parents. And then I was packed off to boarding school and had a kind of trad Victorian experience. So I come at this from both ends. And I tend to think, you know, it probably did me good to be kissed and cuddled by my parents as a child and allowed to express myself. But at the same time, having a good, structured, repressive environment is what gave me the deep emotional continence and trauma that I carry with me today. It's coming a lot of good.
And Jean, what do you make of boarding school specifically? Because over here in the UK, there is a big debate about whether it's damaging to children. Some people say it's hugely damaging. Some people, like Mary in her column this week, say it's very character building. Where do you stand on boarding school?
Well, not as common here in the US. So I don't know as much about it. I would imagine that a lot of it might have to do with age, that if you're sending kids at 7, which I know happens, that's maybe a little young, especially when you're thinking about attachment to parents and caregiving overall and what we know, you know, in the research on that. But if we're talking, you know, 11, 12, 13, it might be a different story. You know, at those adolescent ages, having those independent experiences apart from parents are not just character building, they're developmentally necessary. So I think a lot of it may depend on that.
I think you make a good point, Jean, to make that distinction. I remember reading Alex Renton's very fierce book about boarding schools a few years ago. And Alex does sort of say, I mean, he talks about boarding school syndrome and he regards boarding schools as being, you know, the incubators of all the trauma and unhappiness of the English upper class, you know, male. But he does sort of draw a distinction and say, going away at 13, some people have a good time. And he more or less says, if you pack your children off at the age of 7, that's a form of child abuse. I don't know where it goes as far as that, but he draws a strong distinction, even as an anti-boarding school person, between those two developmental stages.
Jean, there's a statistic that you've quoted in an interview before with Mary, that 30% of American girls have clinical depression. What do you think is causing this?
Yeah, so we see this across the board. So depression, anxiety, unhappiness, loneliness, self-harm, just across the board, there's been an enormous increase in mental health issues among teen teens and young adults in the US and in the UK and in many other countries around the world. It begins around 2012. So the usual pattern is that there's not much change or even some improvements in these indicators before that, say from 2000 to 2011, not a whole lot happens. Then there's a sudden increase, and it's big. You know, teen depression, say among U.S. teens, doubled between 2011 and 2019 before the pandemic. So it's clear it's not due to the pandemic, since most of the change happened before then. But 2012 happens to be the year that the majority of people owned a smartphone. It's also around the time that social media became much more popular, if not mandatory, among teens. It's also around the time Facebook bought Instagram. Smartphones started to have front-facing cameras. A lot of things converge around that time. Plus, it's not just those spending time online. It's also that's around the time there's a huge acceleration in the decline of spending time with friends in person among teens, and less time sleeping. So you put these three together: a lot more time online, especially social media, less time with friends face-to-face, and less time sleeping. Big changes in how teens are spending their time outside of school, like a fundamental difference, and in a way that's a terrible formula for mental health.
And Jean, one of the topics that Mary also talks about in her column is therapy for children. Where do you stand on that? She says that it encourages children to focus too much on their feelings, and that's not necessarily a good thing. What would your take be?
Yeah, so again, it's some agreement, some disagreement. So there have been some studies to suggest that trying to teach all teens, whether they're depressed or not, therapy-like techniques of coping, even, some cases meditation, which you'd think would help, they can sometimes backfire. A study in Australia showed that maybe focusing too much on feelings for your average teen might not be the best thing. However, for teens who are depressed, therapy works. I mean, it doesn't work as well as it does for adults, so we have to keep that in mind. But if you look at teens who are severely depressed, only about half of them are getting therapy. So my fear is that there's a lot of teens, many more teens than 10, 15 years ago, really do need therapy. And if the discussion is, oh, therapy's all bad or it makes things worse, that is a little, I would even say possibly dangerous, because we already are at a state, at least in the US, where only half of teens who really truly do need help are getting it. And I'm just really cautious of the discussion around therapy turning so negative, because how can you tell the teen who maybe is just a little sad and then depressed, especially for teens? Sometimes it's very hard for parents to tell. So I think this idea that, oh, I'm going to put the kid in therapy and then that's going to tell them there's something wrong with them is really mistaken too, because maybe that says the parent cares about you and thinks that it might be a good idea for you to get help and feel better.
And that's everything this week. As ever, please keep sending us your feedback. We've enjoyed reading all of it. It's been so helpful, so thank you for that. Do keep them coming in to podcast@spectator.co.uk. As ever, if you've enjoyed the podcast, you can pick up a copy of the magazine and read everything we've talked about, plus plenty more. I'm Lara Prendergast.
And I'm Gus Carter, and we hope you join us again next week.